There's only one chapter left in this unit, which is about photosynthesis. And don't look at your notes, just tell me from your studying. And if you haven't been studying yet, you will not like this upcoming test. What is the truly important thing that photosynthesis accomplishes? What is it that photosynthesis does that no consumer of any type is able to do?
Converts light energy into other energy?
Well, it's true that photosynthesis does that, but what is the form of the energy that gets produced? What is that energy in the form of? Well, no, heat energy will be wasted because it can't do any work.
Stored energy?
Yeah, but stored in the form of what?
Okay.
It's stored in the form of organic molecules. And so the answer to my original question, what photosynthesis does that's truly important, is it produces organic compounds out of inorganic compounds. And what is that process just by itself called? What's the name for producing organic compounds using inorganic sources of carbon? That's called carbon fixation. And remember, there are two kinds of organisms, ecologically speaking, in the biosphere: producers and consumers. Producers are really defined by carbon fixation. They're the only organisms that are able to produce their own organic compounds using inorganic compounds as the carbon source. All the rest of the biosphere are the consumers, and they need organic compounds for the same reasons that all organisms do, including the producers. But they can't make organic compounds out of inorganic sources of carbon. Therefore, they rely on the producers to exist. Right? We are consumers. All animals are. We're examples of animals. We either, to get our organic compounds, the molecules that we need to live, we have to either eat producers, like when you eat a plant, for instance, or you have to eat a consumer that eats a producer, or you have to eat a consumer that eats a consumer that eats a producer, or however many stages there are, always goes back to producers, because they're the only ones that can produce these organic compounds. That's the remarkable thing about photosynthesis. And in this opening slide, we can see some examples of photosynthetic organisms. Now, we are terrestrial animals. We live on land, so we tend to think mostly about things that also live on land and ignore the rest of the world. By far, the biggest and most conspicuous photosynthesizers that we encounter are plants. And they're really important, of course. All producers are really important. But plants are not the only photosynthetic organisms, and they're not even close to being the original photosynthetic organisms. Plants, of course, are eukaryotes, right? Well, photosynthesis as a process, as a biological process, was invented long before plants even existed, long before any eukaryotes existed. Back when there were only prokaryotes, billions of years ago, some bacteria were the first to undergo photosynthesis. So they invented the process. And I spoke a little bit before about the fact that mitochondria and chloroplasts really started out by bacteria being engulfed and surviving that process. That's the endosymbiotic theory. Well, this is why some eukaryotes are synthetic, photosynthetic, because they're the ancestors, they're the descendants of ancestors that engulfed photosynthetic bacteria, which survived and became the original chloroplasts. So the photosynthesis in eukaryotes occurs in the chloroplast as a specialized organelle for that. Of course, bacteria don't have membrane-bounded organelles, so the photosynthetic bacteria do it with the only membrane they have, which is their plasma membrane. But in all eukaryotes, it's done within chloroplasts, including in plants and all other eukaryotic photosynthesizers, which include algae of various types. There are red algae, brown algae, green algae, a bunch of protists, too. And remember that a protist is any eukaryote that's not an animal, plant, or a fungus. Some of those protists are photosynthetic. Not all of them are. But, of course, you also have bacteria, which started the whole process originally, evolutionarily. Okay. Let's go on to 2. And for the rest of the chapter, even though photosynthesis, as I just told you, doesn't occur only in plants, we're going to focus on plants. And the process is basically the same in other photosynthetic organisms. But here we have a plant. And for most plants, the specialized organs for photosynthesis are the leaves. That's not true for all plants. But in any plant, any part of the plant that is green is capable of photosynthesis. You can tell by the greenness. But in typical plants, most of the greenness is in the leaves. They are specialized for photosynthesis. We have plenty of exceptions to that here because we live in a desert. Cacti have modified leaves that become the spines that aren't photosynthetic at all. But notice that the main stem, the main body of the cactus is green. That's what undergoes the photosynthesis. But for a typical plant with leaves, a leaf by itself is kind of like a sandwich as far as morphology is concerned, meaning there's two slices with something in it between. The two slices of bread, so to speak, on a leaf are layers of epithelium, epithelial cells that form layers. That's what epithelia do in our bodies. They form membranes, like the skin, for instance, linings of organs. And between that, whatever kind of sandwich it is, between the pieces of bread, is a layer called mesophyll, which means middle of the leaf, by the way. Phyll means leaf, and meso means middle. The mesophyll is where you find cells that are really specialized for photosynthesis. Those cells in the mesophyll have a lot of chloroplasts in them, and that's what makes the leaf look green, because the chloroplast within a cell is what makes the cell look green. If you think back to the looking at the red onion, not the whole cell is pink, right? Only the central vacuole. Well, not the whole cell for a plant is green, only the chloroplasts are. But there's a hell of a lot of those chloroplasts in the mesophyll cells. In the layers, the two pieces of bread, there is a waxiness to it to waterproof, to seal the upper and lower surfaces of a leaf. But, of course, a plant wouldn't be able to completely seal it and remain alive. And that's because for photosynthesis to occur, there has to be exchange of materials. You have to take in the carbon source, which is inorganic carbon dioxide, and you have to get rid of the output, the thing that photosynthesis spits out as a waste product, which is oxygen. Well, and also water vapor, even though it's not shown here. So this more or less waterproof surface is perforated here and there with little holes called stomata, which is a plural word. The singular is just stoma, which means mouth or opening. the stomata are not actually structures. They're just the spaces, kind of like the pupils of your eye. It's not a structure. It's just a hole in the iris. What forms the space, though, which can open and close, are a pair of cells called guard cells that by either swelling or shrinking can open and close the stomata. So the cell can control how much gas exchange can take place. We can see a close-up of the mesophyll cell here, a typical mesophyll cell, which has a lot of different chloroplasts in it, and we see one chloroplast in detail to the left of that. We've looked at chloroplasts before, but remember that a chloroplast, just like the nucleus and just like a mitochondrion, is a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. It has more than one membrane. There's an outer membrane, an inner membrane. Those are both more or less smooth, but then the inner membrane becomes folded inside and highly elaborated, folded back and forth many times to form this third category, the green surface here, which is called the thylakoid membrane. And the thylakoid membrane, it's all one membrane, even though these look like separate little sacs. When you look at the cutaway view, you can see that the space is common to all of them. So it's just a very highly elaborated membrane. And therefore, we can talk about three different spaces in one chloroplast. Just like there are two chambers in a mitochondrion, there are three in a chloroplast. There is an intermembrane space between the outer and inner membranes. The fluid that's inside the inner membrane but outside of these green structures is called the stroma, which you need to be careful with as a word because it's not the same thing as a stoma, also on a plant. Stoma is an opening, a stroma is a fluid. And the compartment that's inside all of these green things is called the thylakoid space because these green things are called thylakoids. I just told you they're not really separate from each other, but we name them as separate thylakoids because each one looks like a little coin. And one stack of those coins, or one stack of thylakoids, is called a granum, which is the singular. But there are multiple grana, the plural, within one chloroplast. That's the basic anatomy. Now let's go on to three, and I want you to remember how we started the previous chapter, which was about the complete oxidation of glucose. That's one of two reciprocal processes, right? Photosynthesis is the other. Why do I say that they're reciprocal? What does it mean that they are reciprocal processes? In a sense, they're opposites, but what do you mean by that? Why? What does it mean to be an opposite process? Well, neither process can happen both ways. Each process happens in only one direction. But being reciprocal processes means that each process undoes what the other process does. And remember, we talked about the fact that neither of these overall processes, photosynthesis or complete oxidation of glucose, occurs in one step, one reaction. There's many, many reactions. But we can summarize each process with an equation pretending like it's one reaction, right? We call that the summary reaction or summary equation, I mean. And I wrote that out before to show you that they're opposites of each other. When I wrote out the summary reaction for photosynthesis, it was slightly different from what you see here. You start with a carbon source, so there's six carbon dioxides and six waters, is how I wrote it, become glucose, C6H12O6, plus six oxygens. That's a little bit different here, because notice what we have here in reactants is six carbon dioxides and 12 waters. But I just simplified it because water is both a reactant and a product when you really get down to the specifics. So you can subtract from both sides of the equation six waters, and they disappear from this side, and you only get six to start with. That's why I wrote it that way. They're both right. But the reason this slide is drawn this way is to show you where these atoms that are in the reactants end up. What I mean is that you might think, for instance, that the oxygen that photosynthesis produces as a waste product comes from carbon dioxide, because there's oxygen in carbon dioxide. You might think, well, they just strip the carbon off and that's where the O2 is. That's not what actually happens, though. You can see that the oxygen produced by photosynthesis comes from water. And we'll talk about the fact that water gets split. That's an important part of photosynthesis. It gets split not to get oxygen, because oxygen, like I'm saying, is from the viewpoint of photosynthesis, is just a byproduct. The reason water gets split is because of the hydrogen, and that leaves oxygen after you make that split. I'll explain that a little bit more later. The carbon, though, of course, comes from the only place in the reactants that is carbon. Just remember, CO2 is inorganic, even though it contains carbon, and this is why this is considered carbon fixation. CO2 to us is totally worthless as a carbon source, because we are not producers. We can't use carbon dioxide to produce organic compounds. We have to have others do that, the producers, and then we eat them. That's how we get our carbon. That's how we get our organic compounds. Photosynthesis, though, incorporates this inorganic carbon into organic compounds, and that's carbon fixation. Now we can go to 4, which is a summary of photosynthesis. This is kind of similar to the summary slide we looked at in the previous chapter for the complete oxidation of glucose. One difference, though, is if you remember the summary slide for the complete oxidation of glucose, which has two major parts, right? Glycolysis and cellular respiration. Glycolysis happened in one place, the cytosol, and cellular respiration happened in another place, the mitochondrion. Well, in photosynthesis, the entire process occurs within the specialized organelle, which is the chloroplast. So there isn't a part that occurs in the cytosol and then things get imported into the organelle. If you want to think about goals, the goal is carbon fixation. That's what photosynthesis is trying to do, so to speak. It's trying to produce organic compounds. But doing that requires two major subdivisions of the overall photosynthetic process. And that's what you see on left and right here, the two major parts of photosynthesis. Now, this book labels them as light reactions and Calvin cycle. But they have gone by different names in history. Originally, textbooks called these the light reactions and the dark reactions. And you don't see those names anymore in modern textbooks because it's kind of misleading. If you call something the dark reactions, it implies that you need darkness for them to happen, and that's not true. Instead, you just don't need light for them to happen. So the better words that are used in textbooks nowadays are the light-dependent reactions, saying that these ones need light, and the light-independent reactions. But the light-independent reactions are often still called eponymously, named after a dead person, the Calvin cycle. All right, so Calvin cycle and light-independent reactions are both acceptable names. And light reactions is really just kind of a nickname for the better phrase, which is the light-dependent reactions. These two things accomplish different things, but if you think about it as the goal, it's the Calvin cycle, the light-independent reactions, that actually accomplishes the goal. That's where carbon dioxide, inorganic carbon source, becomes incorporated into organic compounds, specifically sugars. That's what photosynthesis directly produces our sugars, which are organic. But once you have organic compounds in some form, these sugars, you can rearrange the atoms to produce other organic compounds. So it's not that, you know, so all the other kinds of organic macromolecules that we talked about in that chapter, those can all be produced from the starting point, which are these carbohydrates that photosynthesis produces. So the light independent reactions is what really accomplishes the overall goal of photosynthesis. But think about this process. You're taking carbon dioxide, a simple molecule, and building a much larger, more complex molecule. So on energetic terms, how would you define that? What would you expect that to be energetically?
Endergonic,
exactly. That's never going to happen on its own, right? You have to supply energy to build bigger, more complex things out of smaller, less complex things. What's the corresponding word you would use to describe what kind of metabolism that is? Energetically, it's endergonic. What would it be metabolically?
Anabolic.
Because catabolic is tearing things down into smaller pieces. Anabolic is building things up out of smaller pieces. All right? And so anabolic and endergonic correspond to each other, which, notice, is the reciprocal or the opposite of what the other process is. The complete oxidation of glucose catabolizes the fuel to break it down for the purpose of releasing the energy. So it's catabolic and exergonic when you use a fuel. Photosynthesis is producing a fuel, which is endergonic and anabolic. Well, also comparing this to the complete oxidation of glucose, think about ATP's role. Remember, I said that we release energy from our fuels, but that energy that's released doesn't directly drive the endergonic processes that the cell requires. Instead, the energy from the fuel is used directly to store the energy, some of that energy, as ATP form, as a middleman, and then ATP releases the energy to directly drive the endergonic process. In other words, ATP is the energetic middleman. Well, similarly, plants or any photosynthetic organism can't use the energy source directly, which is sunlight, to build the sugars. Instead, the light energy has to first be stored in the form of an energetic middleman, or actually two different middlemen, which then release the energy to the Calvin cycle to build the sugar. And that's what we have here in these arrows. Notice that there are two energy-carrying molecules here, ATP, which we're familiar with, and one that you might think you're familiar with, but it's actually different from what we've talked about before. This is NADPH. We've talked about NADH, right? Which is an important energy-carrying molecule. That's a coenzyme. That's one of those taxis we've been talking about. NADPH is very similar. It's just, it has a phosphate as well. That's what the P stands for. So it's very similar to NAD, but NADP is kind of like a different company, a different fleet of taxis that only work on one side of town, doing a specific job, in other words. NADP works for photosynthesis, but at the same time in the plant, there's NAD doing the same job it does for us, because plants undergo cellular respiration as well. Okay, but it's an energy-carrying coenzyme. And importantly, and we'll talk more about the importance of this a little bit later, the carbon fixation, which is what occurs in the Calvin cycle, the light-independent reactions, that, as we just said, is endergonic, so it needs energy, but it needs energy specifically in both of these forms, not just ATP or not just NADPH, but both. And that's why they are both inputs into the Calvin cycle. Well, it should already make sense to you, since we've already been through the complete oxidation of glucose, that when you spend energy from ATP, that turns it into ADP, right? It dephosphorylates it into ADP and inorganic phosphate. So that one of these things coming out of the Calvin cycle is a partially spent ATP. It's an ADP. And when you spend the energy that's in a reduced coenzyme, a full taxi, you do that by emptying it of its passengers. So NADPH gets transformed into NADP+, which is the oxidized form. Just like NAD+ is the oxidized form, for NADP, the oxidized form is NADP+, the lower energy form. So that's what drives the Calvin cycle, to produce the sugars, sources of energy in the form of ATP and NADPH. But that then leaves these lower energy carriers, which have to get re-energized. And they both get re-energized by the first part of photosynthesis, which is the light-dependent reactions. Named for the fact that they require light, which makes sense, right? Hopefully it does, because light is energy. That's the input that drives all of this. And in the light reactions, some of that energy in light gets harnessed to reduce NADP plus into NADPH. Now it's carrying some of the energy that was in sunlight. And some of that light energy also gets harnessed to phosphorylate ADP into ATP, which is now carrying some of the energy that was in sunlight. And so that's why this is a continuous trade-off between the light reactions and the light-dependent reactions and light-independent reactions. They're swapping materials because of the energy involved. Now, that's not the only inputs and outputs to the light reactions, though. Notice that materially, the input into the light reactions, other than these energy-carrying molecules, these coenzymes, the material input is water. You're already familiar with the fact that there's two basic things you have to give a plant, right? Light and water. Well, the water, we'll see why that's important when we look at the details of the light reaction. But, as I showed you in that previous slide that is the summary reaction, the material output is oxygen. All right? Light is an input, but it's not a material. It's just energy. And that gets harnessed in the form of reduced coenzyme and phosphorylated ATP. Slide 5. Well, we're talking about photosynthesis, which is driven by light, so let's take a couple minutes and discuss what light is. Light is energy, but there's more specifically, light is an example of electromagnetic energy. Or electromagnetic radiation, same thing. It's called this because there's a magnetic component and an electrical component, which is not so important in this class, but that's why it's named that. You get more of that detail in physics. Electromagnetic radiation is a little bit weird because there's a duality to its nature, meaning that in certain ways it acts like a particle. It has even though there's no mass, there's no matter, but it acts like a particle, which we call photons. A photon is a little packet of light energy. But in another sense, light acts as a wave. So there's a particle nature to light, and there's a wave nature to light. And waves, which I've just drawn, if something occurs as a wave, then you can describe that wave with various measurements, one of which would be the wavelength. as the name implies, it's a distance, a length. A wavelength is simply the distance between two corresponding parts on the wave. You could measure it from peak to peak, or from trough to trough, or from anywhere to the next corresponding point in the pattern. All right, so that's one wavelength. And different kinds of electromagnetic radiation are different only because of their wavelengths, meaning it's the same stuff. Notice the spectrum here. What we call light, usually we're referring to humanly visible light, light that we're able to see, which is just a little sliver of the overall spectrum of electromagnetic radiation. And this little sliver, which we're looking at detail here, is just light that has wavelengths somewhere between roughly 400 and roughly 750 nanometers. All right? But, like I said, all electromagnetic energy is the same stuff. It just differs in wavelength. If you have a longer wavelength, it would look like this. Shorter wavelength, like this. Well, if you get a short enough wavelength, namely 380 or so, then the wavelength is too short to cause any interaction with our retina, and it's invisible to us. But it's the same stuff as light. It is light, it's just not visible light. And we call that ultraviolet in this range because violet is the color that we perceive for light of the shortest wavelength that we can actually see. Ultraviolet, above violet. But if you get even shorter wavelengths, then you get into X-rays, which are also invisible light. Anything smaller than 380 as a wavelength is invisible. UV, notice, is dangerous. So the shorter the wavelengths you get, the higher the energy you get, and it becomes dangerous. So UV light causes cancer, for instance. If you get even shorter, then you get even more dangerous light, X-rays, which is why you have to be careful about, you know, the X-ray technician always hides behind the shield when giving you an X-ray. And even shorter than that, gamma rays, which are really dangerous, but thankfully those don't really reach us because the atmosphere filters them out. Okay, well, then we have the visible range, which is often taught as Roy G. Biv, right? Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Notice, though, that you might be thinking red is higher energy and blue lower energy because red seems hot and blue seems cool. But really, it's the other way around. Red are the longest wavelengths and therefore the lowest energy that we can see. Violet is the shortest and higher energy. But anywhere in that range, we can see. And then if you get longer than that, you're once again in invisible light. Infrared light is because it's below red. And then even longer are microwaves, the things that you heat food with or that your phone is operating on. And even longer than that, radio waves, which are very long wavelengths that are passing through us all the time. That light is going through us, through the building. We just can't tell. It's there, though. All right, so we're in a chapter about plants. Why am I talking about humanly visible light? Because roughly the same range of wavelengths works for plants similarly to how it does in our eyes. They both use pigments that are sensitive to about the same range of wavelengths. So what's called visible light here is also important for plants for photosynthetic organisms in general. So let's look at a plant being stricken by light. This is not a plant. It's not even a cell. It's one chloroplast. But there is a beam of light, and by a beam of light, I'm talking about not a photon, I'm talking about quadrillions of photons in that beam. And each photon has a particular wavelength. So sunlight is what we call white light because it's a mixture of all the colors like I was talking about in lab. And I also mentioned in lab that when a photon strikes an object, there's three possibilities, right? It can be transmitted, you can go right through it, in which case the photon still exists. It can be reflected, in which case the photon still exists, it's just going in a different direction now. Or it can be absorbed. And when it gets absorbed, if it does, then the photon doesn't exist anymore. It ceases to exist, but of course the energy is not destroyed. The energy gets delivered to the thing that absorbed the photon. That's why photosynthesis works. And it won't work unless photons get absorbed, because light is the source of the energy to drive the sugar production, just indirectly. Light is directly the source to produce stored energy in the form of ATP and NADPH, and then that energy is used to drive directly the production of the sugars. Now, plants look green to us, but let me just say something about sensation and colors. We often say things like, this thing is green. Well, greenness is not a property of any substance, any material. Greenness is an event. It's a perception. It's something that happens in our brain. We experience that perception. It's not that that material is green. It will look green to us all the time, though, because of what causes the perception. The perception is very high-level processing in the brain. So the eyes don't see. The eyes respond to light hitting the cells, the pigment in the cells of the retina, and then messages are sent to the brain. Once that brain processes that information, that's when the greenness gets produced as a perception, an event in our brain. But a plant looks green to us because white light, which is all the colors, strikes the chloroplast. The pigment that absorbs photons in a plant in order to make all of this happen, which is called chlorophyll, and we'll look at that in detail in a bit, that chlorophyll absorbs only certain wavelengths of light. Now, all the wavelengths are represented in white light. It's a combination of all of them. But if you absorb only some of them, then what's reflected to our eyes is just some of what were there originally. You take out some of the wavelengths. And the reason plants look green to us is because the green wavelengths are not absorbed by the plant. And so white comes in, the plant absorbs everything but the green, and then the green gets reflected to our eyes and we produce the perception of greenness. The plant itself is not green. Okay. We can see this in slide 7 that pigments don't absorb all wavelengths. A pigment, by the way, I think I mentioned this in lab. A pigment is a substance that is able to absorb photons in the visible range. And that's why pigments have colors to us, because they've absorbed some of the light, but not all of it, and they reflect the rest back to our eyes. If something absorbs all light, then it's black. Black is the absence of color, so nothing gets reflected to our eyes. If it reflects everything, it's white, because it comes in as white and all of that gets reflected to our eyes. Well, the pigments that are important for this chapter are the photosynthetic pigments. And there's more than one photosynthetic pigment, even in one single plant. The chief photosynthetic pigment, though, is chlorophyll, which is spelled thus. That's a word that means green leaf. Chloro means green, which is why chlorine got its name. Anyway, chlorophyll is the main photosynthetic pigment, But there are two major versions of chlorophyll, which you see here are chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B. And there are also what are called accessory pigments. And the chief accessory pigment types are called carotenoids. They're all present in the plant, and they're all, by definition of being pigments, they're all absorbing photons. But what this graph at the top, which is called an absorption spectrum, it's spectra is the plural because there's really three graphs in one here, one for each of the traces. What an absorption spectrum is, though, is a graph of how well the light gets absorbed, that's the y-axis, versus wavelength. So for the different colors or the different wavelengths, does that light get absorbed well? You know that if it's a high Y value. And each trace peaks out somewhere. So there are certain colors of light that each kind of pigment absorbs really well, but other colors that don't get absorbed very well at all. This is what I was referring to when I said plants look green to us. Notice that if you combine all of these into one, if you just mentally combine them all into one curve, you would have a big bump here on the blue end and a big bump on the red end, but zero absorption at green. So the white light comes in, the red end, the blue end get absorbed, and only the green light gets reflected to our eyes. That's why they look green to us. The action spectrum in the middle is similar. It corresponds to the shape. But what makes it an action spectrum is that it's not based directly on the absorbance of photons. It's based on how fast photosynthesis occurs given different colors of light. What you see is that green is very low. In the green range of wavelengths, it's very low. And that's because a plant has to absorb the photons to get the energy, and it can't absorb the green frequency or the green wavelengths. Which is why, if you're growing a plant, you don't want to give it nothing but green light. That's the same as keeping it in the dark. It will kill it. You have to give it red and blue, because those are what it absorbs. Well, the bottom one is kind of an experiment to demonstrate that this is true. So what they did was take an alga, which is a photosynthetic protist, but it's kind of like a tapeworm in a sense, that it's the cells are connected to each other end to end. It's a little like a piece of tape, but it's a photosynthetic organism. And you put this onto a glass slide, and you shine light through a prism so that different parts of the slide are given different colors of light. And you measure, and then you have bacteria in here, but they're aerobic bacteria. Aerobic bacteria are bacteria that have to have oxygen to survive. And notice where the aerobic bacteria are growing. They need the oxygen that the alga is producing, because O2 is a byproduct of photosynthesis. Well, in where the green light is shining, there's no photosynthesis possible here because they can't absorb the green light. And therefore, it's not producing oxygen here, and it can't support any bacteria. But at the red and blue ends, the bacteria grow because that's where the oxygen is being produced, because that's where the photosynthesis is occurring. That brings us to 8. And now we're finally looking at an isolated molecule of chlorophyll. Actually, that's kind of a lie. It could be either a chlorophyll A or it could be one chlorophyll B. It just depends on what is in this little box. Notice that the only difference between chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B is this one functional group. If it's a CH3, then you have chlorophyll A. If it's a CHO, you have chlorophyll B. But the rest of this complex molecule is the same in both. And that makes a difference, of course. A and B have different absorption spectra. So they They don't absorb equally well. You know, one of them does better with one frequency, one wavelength. The other one does better with another wavelength. That's why if you have both of them in the plant, you have a better chance of absorbing the light. Now, let's look at the structure of this. The part in the green is kind of the business end of the molecule, because that's what actually makes it a pigment, meaning that's what that end of the molecule is, where the absorption of a photon takes place. Right, in this complex hand. I don't want you to memorize all of this. But notice that the rest of it is largely shown without any letters. But there are, of course, atoms there. This is just shorthand notation in organic chemistry. Whenever you don't have a letter explicitly written in one of these shapes, what that means to a biochemist is that every place where there's a corner, either a bend or a tip, then you just have to mentally put a C there. If it's not a C, then you have to put the actual letter. But if there's no letter there, it's a C. Every little bend. And also, you have to mentally add as many hydrogens as are necessary to complete the valence. So really, this part that has no letters is a bunch of carbons and hydrogens. Just like a fatty acid is, right? A fatty acid, except for the carboxyl end, a fatty acid is nothing but carbons and hydrogens. Whether it's part of a fat or whether it's part of a phospholipid, they both have fatty acids in them. Therefore, chemically, how would you describe this tail here that doesn't have any letters on it?
Hydrocarbon.
It's a hydrocarbon. Now, the whole thing is not a hydrocarbon, but this part of it would be considered a hydrocarbon tail. And that's the importance for this part of the molecule. This part of the molecule, the tail, doesn't have anything to do with absorbing photons. That's the green part. But the tail is important because where the absorption takes place and where photosynthesis takes place is in the chloroplast. The chloroplast has membranes in it, and this hydrocarbon tail keeps the chlorophyll pigment molecules embedded in the membrane. Remember we talked about the fluid mosaic model? And nothing is actually covalently bonded to each other, but they're there because the tails, which are hydrophobic, are trying to avoid the water. Well, this equally hydrophobic tail doesn't want to be around the intermembrane, the stroma, or the thylakoid space, which are watery. So, but it does like to be right next to the hydrophobic phospholipid tails of the membrane itself. So the hydrophobic tail, which is a hydrocarbon, keeps this whole pigment molecule embedded in the thylakoid membrane of a chloroplast. And there's millions and millions of others just like it next to it, embedded in the same membrane. Nine. Now we just looked at the structure of chlorophyll. Let's think about it as a pigment, though, doing the job of absorbing. A little bit earlier I said that when a photon gets absorbed, it ceases to exist, but of course the energy doesn't, right? You can't create or destroy energy. The photon is gone, though, if it gets absorbed. And when it gets absorbed, the photon, which no longer exists, delivers that energy to the pigment in such a way that it is said to excite the pigment. What I mean by excite is that the energy that gets delivered moves an electron that's part of that pigment molecule to a higher energy level. Remember, energy levels are lower the closer they are to the atomic nucleus, and then they go up from there. And electrons want to be at the lowest energy level they can be. They want to be as close to the nucleus as possible, but if, remember, we've talked about the fact that levels can only hold so many, so if there's more electrons, they have to occupy higher ones. But any given electron wants to occupy the lowest level that's available, which is where they were before the photon came along. If a photon comes along and gets absorbed, though, the electron gets excited, which means it goes up at least one, maybe more than one, energy levels. That's what it means to be excited. That's where the energy is that used to be in the photon. It's now in the electron. Well, think back about when we talked about free energy, G. High G value corresponds to instability, right? Systems want to go to lower G values if they can, like falling downhill, for instance. So this is an unstable situation when you have an excited electron due to a photon being absorbed, which means that the electron that just got excited wants to go right back to where it was, that lower energy level. And it will. When it comes back down, it's losing energy. It gained energy from the photon. Now it's losing energy when it goes back to its original energy level. But once again, energy isn't created or destroyed. So the electron losing the energy means that the energy has to go somewhere. So, even though the original photon is gone, a brand new photon gets created when an electron comes back down an energy level. It gets created because that is now the energy that is lost from the electron. A brand new photon is created, and we call this fluorescence. So, this is exactly what happens with fluorescent paint, for instance. Fluorescent paint looks really bright to us, right? But it's not because the light is being reflected. You have to shine light on fluorescent paint for it to look bright, but it's not just reflecting that same light back to you. What happens with fluorescent paint, like on a speed limit sign, if you're out in the middle of nowhere, no city lights, it's dark as hell, only lights are your headlights. When those lights hit the speed limit sign, it looks very, very bright, almost like it's lit up, like it's emitting its own light. Well, it is emitting its own light because the fluorescent paint absorbs the photons from the headlight, excites the electrons, which fall back down immediately and create new light that gets shined from the sign into your eyes. Okay, that's fluorescence. And if you have pigment molecules just in solution, like chlorophyll, which is what this Erlenmeyer flask is, these are not cells. These are just isolated chlorophyll molecules, no living thing, in solution. If you shine light on that, they're going to fluoresce because they're pigments. They get excited and then unexcited and shine their own light. A similar thing, by the way, is phosphorescence. This is what glow-in-the-dark things do. If you have a glow-in-the-dark ball, it doesn't glow forever, right? To get it to glow in the dark, you have to give it light for a while. And then you turn the lights off and it will glow. It's the same thing happening. It's just that in phosphorescent substances, it takes longer for the electrons to fall back down. So over minutes or hours, there are continuously electrons falling down and creating new photons, which is why it's still glowing even when the light is off. Well, fluorescence would be counterproductive in terms of photosynthesis. Because why is the plant or the photosynthetic organism absorbing the photons to begin with? Why is it doing this photon absorption?
Can it use that energy to make ATP?
Yes, exactly. To capture the energy originally in the form of sunlight and put it into a different form, namely ATP and NADPH. In other words, to harness the energy. Well, if the chlorophyll in a plant were allowed to fluoresce, it would make it bright, but that energy would be of the sunlight would be totally wasted because it would shine away the energy as new photons, and nothing would be captured. So the plant couldn't exist. It wouldn't be able to drive the carbon fixation of the Calvin cycle and produce organic compounds. And that's why fluorescence doesn't happen in a plant, even though it has pigments. Yes, pigments just in isolation will fluoresce. But a plant prevents fluorescence from happening because of a special way that the pigment molecules are arranged and complexed together with proteins in a plant. It prevents the fluorescence and therefore allows for the energy that's absorbed to be put to use. Fluorescence would not allow it to be put to use. Well, that brings us to 10, which is what shows you this special arrangement I just talked about. This is a membrane, obviously, but it's not the plasma membrane. This is just a little piece of the thylakoid membrane. The green coin-looking things are the thylakoids. So we're not only inside a cell, we're inside a much smaller chloroplast, and specifically we're in the cross-section of just one little thylakoid of many that are part of one chloroplast. So this is a very extremely close-up view. And this purple thing that's shown in cross-section, kind of looks like a bell pepper, is called a photosystem, as you see here. A photosystem is the special arrangement I was talking about that prevents fluorescence from happening, which would be wasteful. It allows for harnessing the energy absorbed as photons. But a photosystem has two major components. In lighter blue here is one component called the reaction center complex. And that's why it's in cutaway view, because you wouldn't see it otherwise. That's the middle, that's where the seeds are of the bell pepper. And then wrapping all the way around that in purple are several different light harvesting complexes. The light harvesting complexes do exactly what the name says they do. They harvest the light, meaning they absorb photons. So there's a bunch of proteins in this whole complex holding things in special arrangements, but the green dots that are dispersed throughout the light harvesting complexes, those are chlorophylls and other pigments, carotenoids, accessory pigments, and chlorophyll. All right. So it's a bunch of different kinds of, it's chlorophylls A, chlorophyll B, carotenoids. You can't tell by looking at the different ones here, but they're all dispersed. Okay. If light is shining, that light, like I said, is quadrillions of photons. Any individual photon really has a pretty small chance of directly hitting a pigment molecule. So not even close to all of the light coming in to a plant is captured. If it were, we wouldn't see the plant, right? Because it wouldn't bounce any light to our eyes. But even light that doesn't get bounced to our eyes doesn't necessarily get absorbed. A lot of it just goes through the plant because, you know, photons are so tiny and these pigments aren't everywhere, so it's possible for a photon to go between pigment molecules and not get absorbed. Still, though, there's so many photons in a beam of light that some of those photons are going to just randomly strike a chlorophyll molecule somewhere, a pigment molecule, but it's mostly chlorophyll. Now, it doesn't have to be this one in this position. That's just the cartoon. It can be any of them. But if a photon does directly strike a pigment, then that pigment, that chlorophyll, is going to get excited, like we just talked about. And because of how it's complexed with the proteins, it's not going to fluoresce after it's excited. That's what would be wasteful. So instead, represented by the black arrow, the excitation of one pigment molecule more or less gets transferred to a nearby pigment molecule in the light harvesting complexes. Now, how this happens is beyond the scope of this course, but I can tell you the name of how it happens. It's called resonance energy transfer. And resonance energy transfer is the transfer of energy of excitation from one pigment to another pigment without producing any photons. In other words, without fluorescing. So the energy isn't lost, in other words. Each black arrow represents resonance energy transfer from one pigment molecule to another. So the excitation, once it happens, which requires the photon, the excitation bounces from here and there within the light harvesting complexes from one pigment molecule to another. Eventually, though, it will reach a special pair of chlorophyll molecules that are in this reaction center complex in the middle of the bell pepper, middle of the photosystem. And that's a big deal because this special pair of chlorophylls that are in the reaction center complex, if they get excited, they get really excited, more than the other normal ones in the light harvesting complex. What I mean by that is that their electron doesn't just go up an energy level and stay with that atom. They get so excited that the electron actually leaves the pigment, which is what the E minus represents. It's actually leaving. It's ionizing this pair of chlorophylls. And the electron is going to a different molecule. It's a transfer of electron. Well, that different molecule that accepts that electron is called the primary electron acceptor. Pretty descriptive name. Now, how would you describe what's going on there chemically? If this special pair of chlorophylls is losing an electron and the primary electron acceptor is accepting an electron, then by definition that is what? What process? What's the gain of an electron? What's the loss of an electron? Therefore, the answer is redox. There's redox happening here in the reaction center complex. Spurred on, though, by a photon of sunlight, or artificial light will work also, spurred on by a photon being absorbed by a chlorophyll somewhere. And then that energy being transferred by resonance energy transfer. All right? That's how a photosystem captures light. Now, we're not even close to producing any sugar yet here, which is the goal. This just accomplishes transduction. Transduction is conversion from one form of energy to another. So we're going from radiant energy, which is light energy, originally, to energy of a reduced compound. Just like the taxis, when they're reduced, they're carrying energy, right? Well, this primary electron acceptor is now carrying energy that used to be in sunlight, but it's in a different form now. It's no longer light energy. So that's transduction. We haven't yet made any ATP or NADPH either, but at least the light has been captured. And that's how a photosystem works in general. That brings me to 11. This is a cartoon that explains or that depicts the light-dependent reactions. That's the part one of photosynthesis, the left part of that summary slide I showed you. And what's happening here is happening in millions of other copies of this whole thing. So this is just one setup, but this one setup involves two photosystems. We just looked at a photosystem. There are two photosystems here. And notice that they are labeled photosystem 2 and photosystem 1. And you might be saying, why in the hell did they not put photosystem 1 on the left, since it's the first one? Well, that's a good question. That the answer is they were numbered in the order in which they were discovered by humans. We just happened to discover the second one to occur, the second one to function first. So we named it photosystem 1. And then later we discovered this one, called it photosystem 2. But in photosynthesis, photosystem 2 works first. Don't be confused by that. That's why it's like that, though. Okay, so these are slightly different photosystems, but they're both built more or less the same, like that photosystem we just looked at. Photosystem 2 operates first. Photosystem 1 operates later. They're both embedded in the thylakoid membrane, just like the previous picture. Okay? But linking these two photosystems, and also part of the membrane, is this thing between them, which is an electron transport chain. Now, you already learned about an electron transport chain in the previous chapter, right? That electron transport chain for cellular respiration we studied. What was the purpose of the electron transport chain in the previous chapter, in the complete oxidation of glucose, or specifically in cellular respiration? What did that electron transport chain accomplish?
Accepting the electrons from the carriers.
Right. And then doing what with them?
Moving down the chain to eventually be absorbed by oxygen.
Yes, that's what happens to the electrons. And why did the mitochondrion do that? What was the payoff of that? What does the transfer of the electrons down the chain accomplish? Remember that the electrons lose a little bit of energy as they go from member to member of the chain.
For the photons to be embedded into the membrane?
Not to be embedded, but to be pumped through the membrane. Exactly. The release of energy by electron transport provides energy necessary to pump protons from one side of the membrane to the other. In other words, the payoff of electron transport is production of a gradient of protons, which is a stored form of energy in itself, right? Well, think about what the final step of cellular respiration, which is chemiosmosis, that uses that gradient of protons, right, to do what? In cellular respiration. Once the protons are pumped from one side of the membrane to the other, they want to get back through the membrane by diffusion. What's the only place they're allowed to do that? The little molecular machines I was talking about. What's the name of the molecular machine?
ATP synthase.
ATP synthase, so named because it synthesizes or brings together ADP and phosphate to make ATP. Right? So that is what electron transport does in cellular respiration. It allows for production of ATP. This isn't exactly the same electron transport chain as for cellular respiration, meaning that the members are not identical molecularly, but it works for the same purpose. This electron transport chain will transport electrons, creating a proton gradient, which allows for production of ATP, just like in cellular respiration. All right, but this is not part of cellular respiration. This is an electron transport chain between the two photosystems in the light-dependent reactions. Now, photosystem 1, which remember is the second photosystem, has another electron transport chain after it. But this one does not function for production of ATP. This one, the electrons that come down this chain, go into reducing NADP plus into NADPH. All right? That's what the light-dependent reactions do that is so useful to photosynthesis. They capture the energy of light and through electron transport create both of the two specific energy-storing molecules that the second part of photosynthesis, the light-independent reactions, or the Calvin cycle, require to build the sugar. It produces ATP and it produces NADPH. Both of those energy sources I showed you in that slide showing them going back and forth between the Calvin cycle and the light-dependent reactions. This is the light-dependent reactions. All right? Let's look at how it works, though, which I might not finish it today, but let's start at least. So just like I was talking about before, in photosystem 2, the first photosystem, a photon strikes a chlorophyll, it gets excited, and it transfers that excitation by resonance energy transfer to other pigment molecules until eventually the reaction center complex special pair gets excited and really excited so that it loses its electron, which goes to the primary electron acceptor. All right. Now the primary electron acceptor has an extra electron, but it's not going to hang on to it, just like the taxis in cellular respiration don't hang on to theirs. Right? They dump their passengers off to an electron transport chain. Same thing's happening here. The primary electron acceptor, once it receives the electron, passes it on to the electron transport chain between the two photosystems. And that's what allows for the pumping of protons and the production of ATP. All right, now a little bit ago you said that oxygen was involved in cellular respiration because something has to take the electrons from the end of the chain, right? It's a little bit different here. At the end of the chain, well, the chain will, just like in cellular respiration, the chain will stop functioning if it fills up, meaning you have to empty the chain at the other end. Something has to take the electrons. Well, let's see how that works. In photosystem 1, the second photosystem, it's simultaneously being excited by a different photon of light. All right? So its reaction center complex gets excited and loses its electron. But one thing I didn't mention is that when this special pair gets excited and loses its electron, that's a very unstable situation. In a sense, this special pair really wants an electron back. It just lost it. Doesn't have to be that electron. Any electron will do, but it wants an electron back very badly. So this one in the second photosystem that loses its electron, this special pair gets its electron replaced by the one that comes down the electron transport chain between the photosystems. Okay? So an electron that started out in this photosystem 2 is now going to replace the electron that gets lost in photosystem 1. Is that clear? Okay, and then the electron that gets lost from photosystem 1 goes to this second chain, and those electrons coming down that chain plus protons from solution combine to form hydrogens that get stuck onto NADP plus to make NADPH. Both of the energy-carrying requirements for the Calvin cycle are produced, in other words, by the light-dependent reactions. So I'm not quite done with the slide, but we'll stop there. I'll give you something to chew on over the weekend.